Good evening. This is Karen Seidman. Welcome to our 11th functional needs presentation. Is Linda Miller, and she is an RN. She's certified as an oncology nurse, and she works at Metro Health Medical Center, where she has been working in the Cancer Care Center for about 4 years. Right? She will talk to you about treatment modes for people with cancer and some of the usual side effects, also what assistance people may need in shelters. Linda will also lead a short discussion about end-of-life care and meeting the needs of people in that group. As you can see our agenda, we're going to have opening remarks, and then as soon as I'm done, Linda will talk to you, and then we'll have questions and answers afterwards, and we will go in the following order. It will be Ashland County, then Ashtabula, and then Cuyahoga County. So if possible, if you can save your questions till we finish and do them in sort of an orderly fashion, that would be great. The goal of today's meeting is to plan and operate emergency shelters and points of dispensing in Northeast Ohio responsive to the needs of all community members, and that has been our goal for each of these. Our objectives today, to be able to identify three methods. Okay, so the second objective is to list at least two common side effects of chemotherapy and describe methods of treating them. And then the final one is to list at least two symptoms experienced during the end-of-life care and actions to relieve those symptoms. And so with that, we are ready to move on, and I will turn it over to Lynn.
Thank you for having me tonight. I'm sorry, my voice is a little scratchy. I lost it last week, but it's finally coming back. So in order to fully understand the impact that cancer has on our community members, I would like to share some statistics. We won't go into a lot of statistics, but I think they're important. You got that? Okay. In 2014, the American Cancer Society has reported that over 1,600,000 new cancer cases are in the United States, with over 585,000 deaths. Cancer is the second most common cause of death, which equates to 1 in 4 people that have died from something, I guess it is. In Ohio alone, there are over 67,000 new cases of cancer. Cancer will become the leading cause of death in the U.S., surpassing heart disease. Next, okay. According to the American Society of Clinical Oncologists, they report that by 2030, new cancer cases are expected to increase by nearly 45%. From 1.6 cases to 2.3 million cases annually. It is interesting to note that two-thirds of Americans now live at least 5 years after their primary cancer diagnosis. That's really saying a lot for how far we've come with treatments and also the symptom management and also the testing that we have, like pap tests, mammograms, and things like that. Okay. As you can see, these figures, As you can see, these figures indicate that we must all be aware and knowledgeable of issues that will not only impact these patients themselves, but also the community volunteers and professionals that will be interacting with them. Okay.
Next slide.
Next slide. Okay, there are three types of cancer treatments. We have surgery, we have radiation, and we have chemotherapy. You can give a treatment, I'm not much of a public speaker. You can either do it singly, a single modality, or in combination thereof. Next slide. For example, with breast cancer patients, with breast cancer patients, a lot of times they will give radiation to shrink the tumor. They'll then perform surgery on the breast to remove the tumor, and then afterwards they will give chemotherapy to eradicate any microcancer cells that may be going through the system. As in lung cancer, you can have one or all three of the modalities to treat lung cancer. Okay, next slide. My focus this evening will be on chemotherapy and radiation, their side effects, and we as community emergency volunteers and what we should be aware of in dealing with cancer. Next slide. Okay, chemotherapy is usually given in an outpatient setting. It prevents cancer cells from multiplying or metastasizing and destroys both good and healthy, good and bad cells. That's an important side note because it not only affects the cancer cells, but it will affect all the other good cells, and that's why some people lose their hair, you lose your fingernails, and it's a systemic therapy, so it goes throughout the whole body. It is given on a scheduled basis. It could be every other week, every 3 weeks, or weekly. And it is that's determined by research and clinical trials to determine the best way to give the chemotherapy and to see how a person could tolerate the chemo. Okay, next slide. Radiation therapy, on the other hand, is a local treatment directed to a specific site. It is given daily over a number of days and weeks. Usually, like at MetroHealth, we give it 5 days a week. We skip the weekends. And like with brain radiation, we give it for a two-week period. Lung radiation, we could do it over a six-week period. Okay. Next slide. Both modalities of treatment have similar side effects. At this time, I'd like to discuss these side effects and what we can provide to help our patients in an emergency situation. Oral chemotherapy, okay. Before I go on, that's the other thing. Let me advise that there is an increasing number of patients who receive oral chemotherapy. This is fairly new in the chemotherapy regimen. It is a pill that is taken usually on a daily basis, and it should be handled with proper protection. We give the patients chemo gloves, okay, to protect themselves, and that's how they, will take the chemo pill. It's very important that you keep it away from people, other children, keep it locked in a safe place because it is highly dangerous, okay? And it can also be given in conjunction with IV chemotherapy. Now, I noticed that with lung cancer, we're giving a pill called Tarceva, and that is given after about 4 treatments of chemotherapy that the patient has failed. It's a fairly new drug, and it's working wonders with lung cancer patients. They take it on a daily basis, and very limited side effects, and they're doing wonderful on it. Okay, next slide. The most common side effect that we have, or common side effects we have, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fever, skin problems, pain, and there's a few others that I'd like to talk about also. Next slide. Fatigue is the number one complaint of people receiving chemotherapy, which is surprising. I always thought before I became an oncology nurse it would be nausea or vomiting. Fatigue is the number one. It is so bad that people cannot do their daily chores. They say that the fatigue is so bad that they can't even get out of bed in the morning. It is it's due to the red blood cells, which provide oxygen throughout the body. The red blood cells are decreased by the chemotherapy. Therefore, the oxygen isn't getting to your organs that, you need the oxygen for to give you the increase in your level of energy. Thank you. We tell them that they should not overexert themselves to conserve their energy. We don't want people going out washing their windows, scrubbing their floors, washing the cars. We tell them, when your counts are low, you can feel it. If you have a low oxygen level, please take it easy, all righty? We don't want you to be in a couch potato, but we do want you to not do anything silly. Go out for a walk. Enjoy the nice weather. And so we suggest that you provide them with frequent rest periods. Eat nutritious foods. Drink plenty of fluids. It can be water, Jell-O, popsicles, Gatorade. Okay? Next slide. Nausea. I think we've all seen on TV and in movies where you have a cancer patient and their head is in the toilet vomiting severely. I would like to say that these days it doesn't happen that often. Okay? It's really phenomenal about the number of emetics, anti-nausea medicines that we have. Okay, we can give a pill. We can give it intravenously, and we have a medication called Aloxi that will last actually 2 or 3 days to prevent any kind of nausea. But in order to prevent the nausea, we also tell our patients, avoid strong perfumes, colognes, aftershaves, okay? We also suggest that they avoid fried foods, spicy foods, overly sugary foods, okay, which is really surprising. Avoid dehydration. Again, fluids are very important to prevent nausea. And don't eat heavy meals. Eat like 6 small meals during the day. You know, I'm not talking about major meals, but like, you know, have a light breakfast, and then mid-morning have a snack. Again, at lunchtime have something that is not fatty foods or fried foods, because that tends to make your stomach really nauseous, okay? I think the most important thing is the perfumes and odors. I think it's very surprising how a patient coming in, and none of the oncology nurses will wear perfume, because that smell will just really make them nauseous. So avoid, you know, even lotions and things like that if you're dealing with a cancer patient. Okay, next slide. Oh, yeah, we have, I said the triggers. It's interesting to note that women are more susceptible for nausea. Younger patients are more susceptible. And if you've had a history of morning sickness, you're more susceptible to nausea, which I find very, very surprising. So as community emergency response people, we should avoid or provide them small, frequent meals. Okay, avoid the strong odors. Make sure that they have their anti-nausea medications with them. Every cancer patient will have anti-nausea medicines, and they should take them as scheduled. Provide dry crackers, some dry toast, and avoid the spicy, greasy, fatty foods. Okay, okay, we went through that, I think. Yeah, provide dry crackers, we did that. Okay, so the next one is diarrhea. Okay. Diarrhea is a common side effect. We do ask that they keep Imodium on hand. It doesn't have to be the brand name. It can be, you know, whatever drugstore's brand is. We suggest the BRAT diet, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the BRAT diet before. Bananas, rice, applesauce, dry toast, okay? Avoid high fiber, high fat, greasy, spicy foods, caffeine, milk, and alcohol. Okay, increase the fluid intake. Again, you'll see the common denominator here is they have to have a lot of fluids. Diarrhea could lead to dehydration, and that's really bad if you're a cancer patient. Next. Okay, fever. This is usually happens to a person during their nadir count. A nadir count is the lowest point that your blood counts will drop to. Okay, and that's usually 7 to 10 days after they have chemotherapy. We have to watch for a temperature increase. We always tell our patients, if you're not feeling well, if you feel kind of funky, take your temperature. If it's more than 100.4, we want you to either call the oncologist immediately, call the nurse, or go to the emergency room. This can lead to a very dangerous situation. They could become septic, which means that their body is fighting a severe infection. So go to the ER or call the oncologist on duty. Next. Chemotherapy patients can be with the general population, but avoid ill people. If you know somebody's got a cold, keep the chemo patients away from them. If you know that there's something going around, I don't know if the flu is going around, try and segregate the chemotherapy patients. Provide isolation if necessary. Make sure you have a thermometer on hand to take their temperatures, because that'll probably be the last thing that they bring with them to an emergency shelter. Okay. Skin problems. This is usually, this deals with people that are receiving radiation. I don't know if any of you have seen the burns sometimes that radiation people have received, but it can be very, very distressing to them. We usually ask them to use Eucerin or Aquaphor. That is a non-greasy, non-alcohol-containing lotion, and that really helps ease the discomfort. Okay, next. Okay, pain. Excuse me. Most of the cancer patients do experience pain. We do give them narcotics, okay? And I don't know if any of you know, but the insurance companies really regulate the amount of narcotics that you get nowadays depending on the prescription. They're being very careful in Ohio now about giving out narcotics. You have to keep them in a safe place, okay? Constipation is a big factor when dealing with narcotics. So you want to make sure that if need be, that they do have a laxative, a stool softener, something like that. Again, the patients are all instructed. When they come in to the oncology center, they get thorough teaching. We have chemo classes to tell them, this is what you need to do. And if anything happens, you call your nurse right away. Okay, next slide. Other side effects, okay? Because, like I said, chemotherapy does affect the good cells. You'll find that depending on the type of chemo, they could get alopecia, which is loss of hair. Especially women with breast cancer, they get a type of chemo that will give them, you know, they'll lose their hair. This can be very distressing to them also. Let's see, numbness of fingers and toes. We have a chemotherapy, paclitaxel, that can be very distressing to the patient because all of a sudden their fingers are going to get numb and their toes are going to get numb. And it's important that they tell us because if it gets worse, and it could get worse, they could actually be a risk for falls, okay? So the doctor would reduce their chemotherapy to try and prevent this side effect. Another chemotherapy that we have is oxaliplatin. They're not allowed to have anything cold, okay? It's really interesting. For about a week after they receive this chemotherapy, they cannot go into the refrigerator. They can't go into the freezer. They can't drink anything cold with ice or anything like that. They have to do everything lukewarm. And if they are going into the refrigerator, they wear gloves. It's really weird. But otherwise, if they don't, they can actually have severe, severe numbness and tingling. In contrast, if they go outside during the cold weather, if they don't have a scarf over their mouth, they're going to have a sensation that they can't breathe. And it's very frightening, very, very frightening. Let's see. Stomatitis, yes. Sores in your mouth. Again, some chemotherapies can cause sores in your mouth. We have solutions that can prevent that. It's called BMX, which is a lidocaine and a Benadryl solution. The worst thing that they could do is not eat because their mouth is sore or their throat is sore with sores. So we want to make sure we know right away if they're having any issues, we can give them a prescription that would numb their throat and their mouth so that they can eat and drink. Okay? Next. Excuse me. Okay. If a shelter resident identifies himself as a person that is receiving chemotherapy, I suggest that you ask him, do you have your pain medication with you? That's one of the important things. Also, do you have your anti-nausea medicine with you? Are you taking oral chemotherapy? And do you have any personal supplies that you may need? Ostomy bags, different sizes, the surgical team will provide them with that. When do you have your next time and treatment? Because that's very important that they stay on a regular schedule. That's the best way that we can eradicate the cancer cells, if they stay on a regular schedule. Okay, next. Okay, have available a rest area, nutritious foods, a lot of fluids. I can't say that enough, a lot of fluids, Imodium, and a thermometer. Okay, so those are the important things I feel. The end of life concerns. I'm not a hospice nurse, and I'm sure there's some people here that may be, but I know that in my personal dealings, people don't want to know about their prognosis. If they do, they a lot of times will deny it. You can sit there and say, okay, you know, this is the last treatment we can give you. Oh, no, there's got to be something more. And, of course, they go on the Internet and find all these other things that they want to do, and sometimes it's very hard for them to understand, you know, hospice is the next choice, okay? We have to really listen as nurses and as volunteers to what the person is saying, you know? We have to provide them the care. We have to ask them, do you have a caregiver? Is there someone that you know, helps you with your daily living thing, daily living chores? But we have to also remember HIPAA, okay? That's a big, big point in medical care nowadays is HIPAA. We cannot talk to even a spouse without the permission of that cancer patient. And you'd be surprised how many cancer patients don't tell my spouse, don't tell my mom that she's got cancer and she's dying. It's amazing to me. But HIPAA is very important. We actually have to have them sometimes sign a release saying it's okay to talk with, you know, my husband or whatever, or my child. So those are the things that we have to be aware of. We have to ask them about their advanced directives. Again, we hand that over to our social worker. She is more equipped to handle their questions about their advanced directives if they want to be a do not resuscitate, or comfort care. And that's something that the social worker, we usually have her handle. She's better equipped with that, a living will, that type of thing. Okay? All right. So end-of-life concerns. Again, I'm not an expert on these, but I have had some dealings with it when I worked on the floor. Pain. We want to make sure that the patient is not in any discomfort whatsoever. I think that's the most important. Secretions. As a hospice nurse, you know that the death rattle, as you would know it, can be very disturbing, not to the patient, but to the family. And there is medication that you can use to dry that up. Constipation, again, we may want to make sure that we have adequate hydration and stool softeners. Anxiety. I've seen anxiety in dying patients where they're just, you know, uncontrollably flailing and things like that. Make sure that the nurse or the doctor can provide, whether it be Ativan, any kind of medication that will provide them comfort. Make sure that the environment is calm. Sometimes you can play a radio with soothing music. That helps the patient also. And difficulty breathing. That, again, you can position them so that they don't have the difficulty. One thing that we did in the hospital that I was amazed that would really help is we had a small fan that actually blew on the patient's face. And for some reason, that really helped them with their sense of dyspnea, which is a difficulty breathing. It really helped them a lot. Next. Okay, live vaccines.
We're switching gears.
Yes, we are. I was asked about live vaccines for a chemotherapy patient. Chemotherapy patients can receive the flu vaccine. It is not a live vaccine, okay, unless they're receiving the nasal, but most adults receive the injection, okay? According to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, you cannot get any live vaccines. So that's really important to note as volunteers, because if somebody comes in and there's a shingles outbreak, you cannot give the chemotherapy patient a herpes zoster shot, okay? Again, the flu mist is a live vaccine, so we can't give them that. Measles, mumps, and rubella. And as you know, at Ohio State right now, they're having this big mumps thing going on, and they're not, you know, if they were a chemo patient, no mumps vaccine. Smallpox and yellow fever. I don't think we've come across that here in Ohio, but if you're a chemotherapy patient, which God forbid he would be traveling out of the country, we cannot give him a yellow fever or a smallpox vaccine. I think those are encompassed. Oh, and chickenpox. Yes, chickenpox is the other one. We cannot give them a vaccine. Now, I don't know about the pediatric group. I only deal with adults, so that may be an entirely different situation, but this is according to the CDC. Okay, next. Yeah, that was short and sweet, wasn't it? Are there any questions? I kind of ran through that. Yes, please.
What are the side effects of radiation?
Mostly, it is also the skin.
Let's repeat the question.
Oh, okay.
Any side effects of radiation therapy?
Radiation therapy, depending on the location, excuse me, you could have your skin, the redness of the skin. You can also have nausea. very similar. If it's in the pelvic area, you can have either diarrhea, and usually it is diarrhea when they do the pelvic area. Lung. Usually what will happen is it will start breaking up the cancer cells, and you'll have a lot of coughing and possibly secretions. But for the most part, I am not familiar with too many. They usually sail right through it. Nausea, yes. Nausea for both chemotherapy and radiation.
Diarrhea?
It could be, if they're doing it in the lung, no, you won't have any diarrhea. It's usually when you do the pelvic area or like the bladder area from the waist down, then you're going to have diarrhea.
And the nausea, definitely.
Nausea, I would say, yes. I would always have antiemetics on hand just in case. You're welcome.
Let's try to go to Ashland. Ashland, are there any questions there?
Okay. Yes. I will start with some questions. I'm sure perhaps maybe some others here have questions. But basically, you know, it seems like for a general mass shelter that we would need to have at least a physician present in order to deal with multiple needs, especially, you know, if you have chemotherapy patients that are running low on their opioids, and I mean, there's a lot of, you mentioned a lot of medicines, so I mean, that's a general observation.
I think usually depending on when they receive their last prescription refill, you know, the oncologists are always on duty. There's always someone that can fill a prescription. Just note that we can't call in a narcotic prescription. Someone actually has to pick up the paper prescription and take it to a pharmacy. So, yes, that may be a problem with the opioids that you would need.
Ray, is there somebody there from the Red Cross or not?
No, we do not have anybody from the Red Cross present this evening.
Okay, I think we have somebody here from Red Cross. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Red Cross, maybe not for the pain medicine, but for other medications, will try to get refills for the patient if they need them. Is that correct? Here? Yep. So it may be more difficult for narcotics and things like that, but if there's like anti-nausea medication or something that they need, that they either run out of or they've left home without it, a lot of times Red Cross can help facilitate them to get some extra medication like that. The chances of having a physician in a shelter, I think, are pretty rare. And remember, these are people who are managing their own care at home. And that's one of the reasons why we sort of stress the idea that it's important to know when their next treatment is going to be, because it's not quite like dialysis, but it's, in a way, it's sort of the same thing, that you would want them to be able to continue that treatment. They may have a little more leeway than they do with dialysis, but still, you would want to make sure that they got back to a physician. And if for some reason they couldn't go back to their own physician, to find an alternative situation for them.
And also, the patients know to call as soon as they're running low on any of their medications. So unless there was a long-term shelter issue, they would have a complete supply of their medication with them, whether it be anti-nausea or their prescription painkillers.
I mean, this is all presuming that the person is not suffering from fatigue and, you know, has the motivation and everything to bring their advanced directives and all of that. I mean, this is a lot of stuff.
It is. The advanced directives are usually in the hospital record. Okay, we automatically scan them into their records. So, you know, that's really not an issue, I don't believe. But like I said, these patients are very knowledgeable. they're not going to go anywhere without their medication. I know that for a fact. And the only thing I think that a shelter would really need to provide is the nutritious meals, fluids, you know, and a bed, a rest period area that they could have. To me, the medications, I don't believe, are an issue unless it's a long-term commitment in the shelter.
Or if they are evacuated in a very quick manner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, if they've had, you know, a couple of hours to think about evacuating, that's one thing. But if they have to leave home very quickly, they may get there without their medications. But, again, Red Cross would make, I think, every effort to try to get those replaced. Barb, you... Okay, let me try to paraphrase that for those in the other counties, that in large disasters like hurricanes and things like that, a lot of times people evacuate without all their medication, and then they sometimes can work with liaisons to the hospitals or to the pharmacy to try to get those medications replaced, because it's not just for cancer patients, it's for a lot of different people that would be in the same boat. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, as much as being a threat of having a gold kit, which would include at least some amount of your prescription, the vast majority of Americans don't have a gold kit. And when they have to go immediately, they don't have that ready to take with them.
Or even to bring a list of their medications would be helpful. Or a gold kit with medicine and would be ideal. Ray, did that answer your questions?
Sort of. The other thing was about the HIPAA forms and mm-hmm. all of that. I mean, does the Red Cross carry those with, you know, with the disaster medicine outfit?
Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about as far as HIPAA forms. HIPAA is a law that says that basically you can't release information to someone other than the patient, and that's sort of the standard in healthcare.
We can get verbal approval, and I have done that in the past where I'll indicate in the chart that verbal approval has been received from, you know, Linda Miller stating I could talk with her daughter or whatever. That's indicated in our chart. Now, as far as in an emergency situation, I'm sure if you noted that on such and such a date and time, Linda has given permission to talk with Charlie, I'm sure that would be fine. If it's in a situation where they're in the hospital and they want to release information to, like from Metro to Cleveland Clinic or to another physician, we have them sign a form stating it's okay to release this information. But usually jotting down or noting somewhere that permission has been given, I think would suffice to avoid any problems with HIPAA.
Yeah, that was the type of answer I was looking for.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bula, do you have questions?
Karen, we don't have any questions. Do you have any questions for us?
Yes. Do you have some folks there from hospice?
Yes, we do. We have three of them here.
Oh, good. Can they talk a little bit about maybe how their patients would fare? Could they add anything?
I'm bringing them toward the phone so they can talk with you. So,
one of the things that we do have is we have two residential facilities, so they would be possible places for people in an emergency to go. And some of the issues that occur with our hospice patients, you know, usually they have their advance directives, and we can certainly help them with that. all were contracted with two pharmacies that would, if they were able to drive, provide pain medication or whatever their medications were 24 hours a day. You know, they're contracted with us. That's part of what they do. So they're always able. And for our hospice patients, they are able to receive a fax for prescription medications. So there are some ways that it would be really advantageous to just either have them in the residential place, but if not, then we could certainly meet their needs wherever they were.
And would they have a phone number? Like, for instance, if they were in a shelter, would they have a phone number that they could reach their nurse or caregiver from hospice?
Yes, we have a 24-hour number that they're always able to get. There's always nurses on call, and there is one central number they could call and be connected with either their nurse or another nurse.
And every patient in home care setting or nursing home setting gets a sheet of paper, and they usually keep it on the refrigerator. In the nursing home, it's in the chart that has, in case of an emergency situation, call this number. So every patient is set up with that, and their families are aware of that as well.
And we're also contracted with all the local skilled nursing facilities in the county, and most of them, or many of them, have respite bed contracts with us. So we'd be able to, if they were open and had beds available, we'd be able to move patients there if it were a more isolated kind of disaster, you know, maybe a hurricane that was only in one part of the town.
Okay. We may come back to you if we have more questions about hospice care. Anything else from Ashley Bueller right now?
I think we're good right now, Karen. Thanks.
Thanks, Debbie. Any questions here at the Board of Health?
I just have a comment. I have a question. But with the narcotics, I guess we have to be careful nowadays that people
don't steal them. That's true. Steal or sell them. Yes,
yeah.
That's true.
Steal them and
sell. Yeah, exactly. We've actually had a cancer patient sell their pain medicine, which was really sad. He really needed it, but he needed money worse, I guess. So, but like I said, Ohio, you know, even if a patient takes too many of his pain medicines within a month, we have a hard time filling another prescription within a 30-day period. Yes.
So any of you who have worked in shelters, would there be a place that they could secure their pain medication? Mary?
Well, shelter that Red Cross is participating in setting up and managing, Red Cross works to develop the community support network that's required for the emergency period. So we've been looking to partner with CVS or whatever the local pharmacy that hopefully Red Cross and other nonprofits can work with to provide the gap coverage for patients that require prescription medication but are, as we heard earlier, out there without their prescription. We do kind of count on patients having, at least in their head, or the client in the shelter, having the name of their doctor, at least. They may not know which of their doctors prescribes the hypertension medicine versus the, you know, the whatever else medicine, but they know a doctor that we can then, the Red Cross Health Services folks can work with the pharmacy to provide a couple of days worth of medication. Assuming we can move around. Now, you can't always move around if it's a flood or there are situations that are much harder than that. But most of the time, that's part of what we expect to do as Red Cross staff in shelter, is to set up a relationship that we can help make sure the medications are available.
So, is there a place sometimes in the shelter where you could lock up medicine, or would it depend on the individual shelter?
There is a requirement to have a health services person on site in the shelter 24/7, as long as the shelter is open, as long as there are clients in the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And we come with a kit and we come with the responsibility to be in charge of that medication and to chart the use of any medication that's in there. I was only over-the-counter stuff in it, and a small amount of that. But for anything else, we would be expected to chart it, just like if the client was in inpatient at a hospital.
Mm. I want to just, I just want to say one thing is that when our cancer patients do come in, we present them with the doctor's card and with the nurse's card. So, and at Metro, of course, we're a teaching hospital. There's always an oncologist on duty, and the nurses, of course, there's a nurse on the oncology floor that there's always someone 24/7 that they can get in touch with. Fortunately, I only work Monday through Friday, but all my patients do have my card and my phone number. Along with their doctor's phone number. So, yes.
Are you talking about the patients coming with their own medication because they would need some safe place within the 5 or 4?
Mm-hmm.
That would be if they came with their own narcotic medication, their own pain medication, if they could store it with some assurance that so they didn't have to worry about somebody stealing their medication. So if you can't hear for the out of the other counties, the discussion is going on about whether or not in a Red Cross shelter there is a place to lock medication. And some shelters that were run by other than Red Cross, that there was a way to lock things up, but some of the Red Cross shelters, I think it would depend on the shelter and the situation. So there's probably not, it's probably dependent on what's available at the time.
So who makes the decision what's kept in? Is there a specific person, or is it the Red Cross across all the United States? In terms of the issues we're talking about here, there is a health services person that is a Red Cross staff or volunteer is a volunteer, nurse, Red Cross volunteer, health service person, encounters a situation that is too challenging and they cannot address in the shelter, then you have staff call on either long distance or close at hand to address any issue that the health services person could not do. But there is always a health services person, and there is a lengthy interview with every client about their position, what their needs are going to be. I think we addressed some of that in some of the earlier sessions we had here where, you know, we had special needs and all of those processes, all of those are included in an initial interview with the patient. I never had the situation where we would have to take, where we would be concerned about the safety of a patient's medication.
Could you use the microphone? We're having a hard time hearing you.
I know, and I'm trying to. So I don't know if you want to come up and use the microphone. They're having trouble hearing. But let me just, you know, it's basically there's a health services person available at a shelter. As long as there are people in the shelter, there's a health services person from Red Cross there, and that would most likely be either a nurse or some other healthcare professional. Is that correct?
A nurse or doctor.
Doctor, pharmacist maybe, or somebody?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So usually a nurse or a doctor, and they would be the ones that would make decisions about safety of medications and things like that. So there's, and different shelters would be stocked differently and may have, some may have that kind of facility and some may not to secure medication. But they all should have the ability to if somebody comes in without their medication, of making arrangements to get refills on the medication to at least while they're in the shelter. Does that help? I'm sorry.
Yes, that was better, Karen.
Okay. Any questions, other questions here? Yes.
Yes. Fatigue is the number one complaint of any patient receiving any type of chemo or radiation. It's so bad that, like, it's debilitating. It really is. And it's amazing to me because I've been an oncology nurse for over 10 years, and I always thought nausea, vomiting was the big one, but fatigue is, people tell me that we can't even imagine how tired they get, that it takes every effort for them to get up and go to the bathroom. And, it's continuum, because once they receive their first chemotherapy and then they go to the second cycle, as we call it, cycles, it's a compounding issue, okay? So. No, radiation also, fatigue. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fatigue is very, very debilitating between chemo and radiation also. And if they get both, that's a double whammy for them. It really is.
Yes.
What we worry about, basically, for patients is the 7 to 10 day period after they receive their chemo. What happens is, at that time, your red blood cells, your white blood cells, and your platelets all decrease from the chemotherapy. Your red blood cells is the one that provides oxygen throughout your body. Therefore, you have trouble with shortness of breath, fatigue. Okay, fatigue again. The white blood cells fight infections. And then the platelets coagulate your blood. Okay. So, yes, the white blood cells, when they are down, you have a hard time fighting infection. But after your 10-day period, your nadir, which is the lowest point your blood count's going to go, your body starts building up again, okay? So if a patient has received chemo today, in 7 days from today, and it's usually 7 to 10 days, it could be a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, in 7 days from today, which would be the 21st, I would be really careful with that patient. So it's very important that you know when they receive their chemotherapy or when their next treatment's going to be, because you can kind of figure out, oh my gosh, they just had chemo, so in 7 to 10 days, we have to be extra careful with them. That's where the thermometer comes in. If they're not feeling well, you know, take your temperature. You know, you don't have to be crazy about taking the temperature. But yes, they're going to be immunosuppressed. All right. But it's usually 7 to 10 days and your body starts building up again. And of course, you know, I tell the patients, use your common sense. You're not going to go and visit your neighbor who has the flu. Or if you want to go to church, make sure that, you know, you're not sitting there next to somebody that's coughing and sneezing. And don't go to the mall if your counts are low. And we always advise a patient when their counts are low, because we usually check to see after their first cycle of chemotherapy, we check their nadir count to see how their body is reacting to the chemo. And if we find that they're really low, then we tell them, okay, now's the time. Avoid people. You know, just stay home for a while and let your body rebuild itself.
So following up on that, can we go back to Red Cross? Sorry, Mary.
Yes.
Is there, if you know that somebody is at risk with being exposed to infections in a shelter, what kind of alternatives would there be?
Well, just like other patients or family situations may request a privacy space, to the degree a shelter can accommodate that, I think at the Red Cross we're directed to trauma, but you can't always. So I think those who've been at the big shelters might have more information to add to that. We have been able, in a couple of shelter situations I've been in health services for, we have been able to find corners in the room for someone. But I've not had a patient that is in treatment for cancer. for a patient that, or a client that said that they were in hospice.
So the answer to that is basically you would try to find some area in the shelter that you could have them be away from most of the people, so that they would, it would decrease their likelihood of getting infected.
To the degree that the shelter arrangement allows for that.
It's depending on the shape and size and so on of the shelter.
One thing I failed to mention, and probably one of the most important things that we as volunteers and professionals can do, is wash your hands. I know you probably have heard that so many times, but you wash your hands before you touch a person, after you touch the person, before eating, after eating, and that's very important around even a healthy person. That's how germs are spread. So, yes, I think washing hands, and I should have mentioned that before, is really important. If you're going to be around these people.
Jenny?
I just wanted to bring up another group of immune suppressed patients that you could find in a shelter, and that's the transplant patients,
yes,
who are on immune suppressants and would, even missing one dose, could actually start rejection of whatever the organ is. So it would be very important that they, if they don't come with their meds, that they also get those.
Okay, so if you didn't hear the question or statement, is the concern also for people who have had transplants and their need to continue on medication if they are in a shelter.
They might also need a special space that, you know, away.
Right.
Yes.
From a military perspective, again, if you're going to have
question here is about airflow in the shelter. I'm sorry, Barbara, you said the people with infectious disease, they would try to move to a hospital ship?
They will try to use them, but it won't happen right away.
Right.
You always have that period where you're going to be
waiting
for people that are in charge of managing the
situation. So initially, as the shelter is set up and people are streaming in,
right,
it's almost impossible to provide those. So initially, as people come in, it may be difficult to separate them and protect them, but
it's important to have masks, not just gloves, but masks and barrier shields and things, because you don't know who's going to come in as a shelter person. I mean, you might get someone who has measles and mumps or even TB, all kinds of things that you would need to keep that.
Okay, so in a shelter, you would want to try to isolate the people who might have infectious diseases.
Right. During the interview process, when they start interviewing, you have to be careful that the interviewer knows that they may need to wear a mask when they're talking to people. Because until you ask them, do you have any infectious diseases? If you go through their medical history, they may or may not tell you.
Okay. So tuberculosis and other infectious diseases are an issue. Patients
sometimes aren't even aware that they have those diseases, or if they are, they might not be willing to share that information. But you might be able to pick up on some symptoms, somebody who's coughing a lot, something like that. Might not be the safest place, but sometimes it's the only option in a large emergency situation. Yes?
Okay, chemo is given in cycles, okay? So every chemo is different, okay? If you have lung cancer, I'll go back to lung cancer, you could get chemo every 3 weeks, okay? The first week is a cycle one. 3 weeks later, it's cycle two, okay? We have lymphoma patients that get treatment every other week. Cycle one would be the first week, and then 2 weeks later, could be cycle two or could still be cycle one, only day 15. So every chemo is different depending on the disease, the type of cancer you have, and the stage of cancer you have. So with each stage of cancer, if you have stage one, surgery may have taken care of it, okay? Stage two, you may need some chemo for a short period of time. Lung cancer, stage three, you're going to get chemo and radiation. Stage four is just strictly chemo. So it depends. I can't give you an exact answer, but once you get chemo, the first time is cycle one. 7 to 10 days later would be your nadir count. That's when your blood counts are really going to drop, okay? Then 2 weeks after that is going to be your next cycle of chemo, all righty? I know it's kind of complicated to hear, but it, like I said, it depends on the type of cancer you have and what cycle or when what type of chemo you're going to get. Every chemo is so different. We have people going home with chemotherapy pumps, okay? So they'll get chemo at the outpatient clinic, and then they get a pump to go home for 48 hours, giving them an infusion of chemotherapy, all righty? And then after 48 hours, they come in and they get the pump off. So that would be a cycle. And then 3 weeks later, they would do the same thing again. So, you know, there's no specific time frame that I can give you other than a cycle is one treatment of chemotherapy. Okay? Yes?
Have people had those pumps during special considerations if they're actively getting it?
Well, special considerations, I guess they have a number that they can call 24/7 if they're having any issues with the pumps, if the batteries go or whatever like that. And it has an LED readout screen that will tell you that there's an issue, maybe the tubing is kinked or whatever. The only other issue is the fact that they have a port, an infuser port. And I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but it's an implantable device either in the arm or the chest that hooks up to the pump, okay? And that could be an issue. If they have to take the pump off in an emergency shelter, you have to make sure that you flush the port, okay, which means you give it saline and heparin so that it locks and it doesn't clot up. That could be an issue. You know, I don't know whether any other concerns. If the pump, you know, doesn't work right, then there's a number that they can call. So the chemotherapy, that's a good question. We have equipment. We have a big yellow bucket that all the chemo bags go into, and that's incinerated. So in a shelter, I don't know. I'm not familiar with shelters, so I don't know, but it would be very important to have like a biohazard bag or something that you could put the empty chemo bags or even the chemo pills or whatever and put them in a bag and make sure it's tightened up and make sure you wear gloves if you ever touch any kind of chemo. I just like to thank everyone. I'm not a public speaker, and I thank you for your graciousness in having me here tonight. So anytime you need anything, you can get my number and call me.
So thank you, Linda, very much. And we will always...